Tonight on PBS News Weekend, candidates make their final pitch in bitterly cold Iowa on the eve of the first contest of the 2024 presidential election. Then the growing humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, 2.5 years after the Taliban returned to power. And why American farmers have some of the highest suicide rates of any occupation, and what some rural communities are doing to help.
I never thought depression would happen to me, but this financial struggle and feeling that you're losing this legacy that your grandfather started, and it just really played a lot with my mind.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight, on the eve of the first contest of the 2024 presidential election, Republican candidates are making last-minute appeals in a frigid Iowa. The National Weather Service is warning of dangerously cold wind chills as low as 45 below Monday night when Iowa Republicans gather for caucuses. Lisa Desjardins has been braving that cold for us and joins us now indoors at Indianola, Iowa, south of Des Moines. Lisa, in your travels around Iowa, what have people told you about this cold? Is it going to deter them from going out to caucus tomorrow night? And are there supporters for one candidate who seem more motivated than others?
Well, as you can see behind me, this is a room where former President Trump spoke not long ago, and it was full of Trump supporters. They came out in negative 21 degree cold. And I can tell you, if you've ever been that cold, it's a bit like having toothpicks stabbed at every portion of exposed body. We came here and we saw a long line of them, enthusiastic to get in, some of them prepared and dressed for this weather, some of them frankly not, and risking frostbite. The Trump campaign did have some buses here so that the supporters could get on board to warm themselves as they waited. Now, one factor here is that former President Trump has canceled 3 events in the last day and a half. So all the more reason, when we talked to folks, we found they were very excited and wanted to be here.
We're all new voters. We just turned 18, and we feel like we go to this college, and we feel like having such a wonderful opportunity to see such a big speaker on campus is worth it.
Support Trump, want to hear what he has to say, but...
Do you think this weather is going to affect the caucuses at all, maybe older voters, or what do you think is going to happen?
You know, I don't think so. I think you see this today. I think the same thing's going to happen tomorrow. You know, I think as long as it's not snowing and, you know, and the weather and everything, the roads are clear, I think people are still going to come out.
Now, there is a lot of discussion in this state about which voters, you're asking the right question, will come out or not in the cold. And I will say the most confident campaign is the Trump campaign. However, I have spoken to voters personally, Trump supporters, who told me that they don't think they will come out for 2 reasons. Some told me they think the former president is ahead by so much that he doesn't really need their help, and why should they go out in the cold? Others say it just simply will be too cold, and either they themselves don't feel that they're up for it, they don't want to risk it, or they're with parents whose health they don't want to risk.
You mentioned that the Trump campaign had canceled some events because of the weather. What about the other campaigns? Has this prevented them from making their final appeals?
I think the campaign most affected by this has been Nikki Haley's. Yesterday, she moved all of her events to become virtual. And this morning, surprisingly, she canceled an event in Dubuque. Even though we know roads are clear, I will say there are still cars by the sides of all the roads. There is still black ice on the highways here. Well, Nikki Haley canceled that event this morning. Ron DeSantis showed up in the very same town not long after. So Haley, I think, has some ground to make up because of the weather.
We got the final Des Moines Register NBC News poll last night, the last one before the caucuses. Any surprises in it, and how does it match up with what you're hearing as you travel around the state?
Well, I don't know if it's a surprise or not, but certainly newsworthy that Nikki Haley has come into second place now in this Iowa poll. Now, this poll by the Des Moines Register and NBC News is sort of seen as the gold standard here in Iowa. And this poll is significant for her to sort of establish herself as a potential second place. But she's not ahead by much. As you can see, Donald Trump, 48 points. That's less than half. And then Nikki Haley with 20%, DeSantis, 16. Now, it's significant, of course, that Haley is up in number 2 there, but But look at that margin. Donald Trump is still ahead by almost 30 points. In any other race, we wouldn't really even be talking about it. There's a question of enthusiasm that you've been raising here, John. And this poll indicated that Donald Trump supporters are by far the most enthusiastic. When asked who was extremely or very enthusiastic about their candidate, 88% of Trump supporters say yes, they are very enthusiastic, compared with a lower number for Ron DeSantis, 62, and a much lower number for Nikki Haley. While she is gaining voters right now, and I can tell you from experience, I've talked to them, they are out there. The question is, how firm are they for Haley? And it's going to really matter with the weather. There's a theory that perhaps she is the most vulnerable to cold temperatures last night, tomorrow night. We will see.
Of course, we had a little change in the lineup late last week. Chris Christie dropped out on Thursday. Was he much of a presence in Iowa before this, and does this make any difference in the race?
No, Chris Christie actually skipped over Iowa. He never planned to do well. He didn't campaign here. However, he did have a few supporters. I spoke with one of them. I think what's more significant is that while polls show that the true undecided number is maybe 5% of Iowa Republican caucus goers, I have talked to many, many voters at every event, DeSantis events, Trump events, just in hardware stores, who say they are stuck between one or two Republican candidates, including former President Trump. I think there are more persuadable voters here making late decisions than many of these campaigns realize.
Lisa Desjardins, staying warm in Iowa right now. Lisa, thank you very much. And Lisa will be in Iowa on Monday night for live coverage of the caucuses, starting at 11 p.m. Eastern here on PBS. It's not just Iowa that was in the deep freeze today. Temperatures have plunged to dangerous levels from the Pacific Northwest to the Rust Belt. In Omaha, Nebraska, it's 11 below zero with wind chills of 25 below. Chicago made it above zero, but not out of the single digits. Thousands of Israelis marked the 100th day of the war against Hamas with a rally demanding the release of the hostages still held in Gaza. It took place in a Tel Aviv plaza that's become known as Hostages Square. There were similar gatherings across the globe, including some expressing solidarity with Palestinians. 132 Israelis are still being held hostage in Gaza, including the remains of about two dozen who've died. Federal officials say a woman and two children drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande from Mexico. It happened Friday in an area of Eagle Pass, Texas, that state authorities have taken control of and barred U.S. Border Patrol agents from entering. It's the latest in an escalating standoff between Texas and the Biden administration over immigration enforcement. And the Iowa high school principal, who was shot several times while protecting students during a school shooting earlier this month, has died. Dan Marburger had been principal at Perry High School since 1995. The January 4th attack at the school left an 11-year-old student dead and six others injured. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the worsening humanitarian disaster in Afghanistan. And a community comes together to tackle the crisis of suicide and depression among farmers.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Since the Taliban reclaimed control of Afghanistan in 2021, the country has plummeted further into political and economic instability. Frequent natural disasters and shortfalls in aid funding exacerbate the dire situation, making it one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Ali Rogan has more.
Almost two-thirds of Afghanistan's population are currently in need of humanitarian assistance, a 45% increase since the Taliban takeover. Meanwhile, donor fatigue has left a humanitarian funding gap of $1.3 million. And in the impoverished West, a string of powerful earthquakes last fall killed more than 1,300 people. Another 6.4 magnitude earthquake hit this region just this week. And now the country is facing an influx of returnees being expelled from neighboring Pakistan following that country's announcement that Afghan migrants were no longer welcome. Dane Curry is the Afghanistan director for Mercy Corps, a global humanitarian organization in town this week. Thank you so much, Dane, for joining us here. Can you first give us an update on just what life is like these days for the average Afghan person?
Well, certainly the humanitarian challenges in Afghanistan are steep, and the situation is dire, particularly economically for the country. especially when there have been multiple emergencies facing the country, both with the earthquake and with the returnee situation. It is a challenge for these communities to recover. The earthquakes in Herat were incredibly devastating. I visited one community where of the 150 villagers that were living in that community, only 5 survived. The impact of the earthquake was severe, and it's going to take a long time for the recovery to occur. When you then add additional regional issues, such as the returnees, you know, maybe as many as 1 million people coming back from Pakistan into an already challenging economic situation, it just creates even more challenges for the ordinary Afghan to be able to make ends meet day to day.
And I know it's even harder for women and girls in Afghanistan. What is the situation like for them now?
We're very concerned about the situation for women and girls. And we obviously can note the social and political challenges that face them, but the humanitarian challenges are of prime importance to us. It is incredibly important that women and girls have access to humanitarian aid, and we work to engage the authorities to ensure that they are able to have access to that assistance. You know, for many women in Afghanistan, it's just a question of how they provide food for their families, that their children are able to get enough to eat, that they have clean drinking water. In some communities, women and girls are forced to walk 2 or 3 hours one way just to be able to find clean drinking water to use in their homes. And so we need to address all of those challenges and situations, and that's the priority for us as a humanitarian organization.
And how have the earthquakes affected the work that you do in getting this humanitarian aid to where it needs to go?
Well, thankfully, we, along with partners, were able to respond very rapidly to the earthquake. The importance for what we see with the earthquake now is beyond just the initial emergency support, beyond that first surge of assistance, is the long-term recovery efforts that will be needed for these communities. This isn't just a one dump of assistance. It needs to be a long-term commitment to make sure that the resilience in Herat province is possible and that people are able to recover in a way that doesn't further exacerbate their vulnerabilities.
And as you just mentioned, there's going to be an influx of up to 1 million Afghans returning. How does that affect the need situation right now?
Potentially, it could be 1 million more. It's already 500,000. Could be 1 million more. And the thing to remember is that just because they're coming across the border on the Pakistani side, they're not staying there. They're returning to their communities of origin and resettling there. And these communities are already stretched. They may not have clean drinking water. They may not have jobs. They may not have just basic means to support themselves. So when you add that many more people into the situation, it underlines the need for funding and assistance that will be committed to the Afghan people for the long haul.
And the hunger crisis is, of course, also worsening. The World Food Program had to cut back its aid to 10 million Afghans last year, and now it can only help 1 in 5. How is that affecting the overall situation?
It affects it significantly. It's important to remember while there's emergency assistance going into these communities, and that's essential to provide that emergency help with food aid, it's also important that there's efforts to support agriculture and livelihoods, ways for communities to be able to provide for themselves so they're not wholly dependent on food aid. And when there are reductions of emergency support, it stresses the importance of trying to be more strategic with that funding so that Afghans can have their own agency to take care of their needs and not be so reliant on that assistance.
State Department, U.S. aid officials have been on Capitol Hill this week testifying about the situation in Afghanistan. Here's what House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McCaul had to say about the situation post-withdrawal.
There are no plans to ensure enduring peace or to support the Afghan people. And now, under the administration's failed policies, Afghanistan continues to deteriorate every day.
We know that many of these issues in Afghanistan right now existed prior to the Taliban takeover. But I wonder, what do you see as some of those solutions that you would like the United States and other partners to focus on?
Right. Well, the United States is obviously the largest donor to Afghanistan and a significant part of what we do. We're thankful for the assistance that the American people continue to provide for Afghanistan, and it's vital. What we would urge the United States government is to not only consider the amount of funding that they're giving, but how they strategically use that money. Like I mentioned, resilience for Afghan communities is important. Helping Afghan farmers to grow more viable crops, helping Afghan women to access the job market and to be able to have the skills to do that. These are all important resilient steps that can be provided for the Afghan people so that the aid that goes into Afghanistan is more effective than it has been in the past.
What are the messages you are hearing from stakeholders who are reluctant to provide that donor money, especially citing Taliban control, making it even harder for example, women to find those jobs that you mentioned?
We understand the concerns and the challenges that donor funding going into Afghanistan presents. It has for a long time presented many challenges, and we as humanitarian organizations take integrity with that funding very seriously. We have measures in place to ensure that the funding that we provide to Afghan people reaches the people that it's intended to reach and can be used most effectively to provide assistance to people in a sustainable way.
Dane Curry, Afghanistan Director for Mercy Corps, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Last year, more than 50,000 Americans took their own lives, the nation's highest yearly rate of suicide on record. What leads to someone's suicide can be a mystery to loved ones because they were reluctant to talk about their struggles. Special correspondent Megan Thompson reports from Wisconsin on the burdens farmers often have to deal with and what's being done to help them.
All of them are that buffy tan. They're so pretty. I hear
ya. Days start early for Brenda Stotts.
Usually 4:30, I'm wide awake, and so I get up, get chores done, usually do chores in the dark.
Stotts runs this 300-acre farm in southwest Wisconsin with her two sons and her daughter-in-law. The farm's been in the family for 50 years. Brenda's husband, Leon, inherited it from his parents.
We met in 1981, my senior year of high school. He just loved the kids, loved the farm, showing them how to farm.
But farming is a hard way to earn a living. Brenda works a second full-time job in town to give the family health insurance and extra income. After the birth of her second son in 1989, Brenda left her job for a while to care for the kids. Leon and the farm became their only source of income.
He told me that one day, he says, "If I fail, we all fail." And that's when his first bout with depression started. He couldn't function, couldn't get up in the morning, couldn't get down to the barn.
Leon struggled on and off with depression for years, the weight of running a farm at times overwhelming. In 2017, the Stotts sold their dairy herd and started raising beef cattle. But Leon came to regret it.
He said, "I should have kept my cows. I'm a failure. I wasn't good at farming, even though financially we were fine." But his mind would not let him see that.
In October of 2018, Leon Stotts took his own life.
Whether he's here or not, somebody still had to get up the next day and feed the cows. Somebody had to get up and do the chores. The crop still had to be harvested that year. There's so much that has to do. You didn't have time to just stop.
Didn't have time to grieve, really.
No.
Farmers are 3.5 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population, according to the National Rural Health Association.
Farmers face really unique stressors in their businesses.
Karen Endres coordinates wellness programs at the Wisconsin Farm Center, a state agency.
They are working in very complex markets. They are often dealing with things like weather that are out of their control.
Endres says most farms are run by families, which can cause conflict and stress at home. Farmers are also operating in isolated rural areas.
They can feel very alone, like they are on an island. And they also have access to a lot of things like large equipment, firearms, things that can cause self-harm.
Everybody thinks farming is the red barns, you know, and the white fences and things like that. But what goes on behind the scenes is it's constantly the stress, you know, of the markets. Animals get sick. Things happen.
Come on.
Randy Roker runs his family's dairy farm just a few miles from Brenda Stotts. He says things are tough right now for dairy farmers who are dealing with drought and sky-high costs for feed and fertilizer while being paid a low price for their milk.
There we go, all in. We do such a good job producing a wholesome product for everybody, and yet we aren't even making enough money to cover our cost of operating.
Roker's grandparents started the farm in the 1930s. When Roker took over, he invested millions of dollars in a new barn and state-of-the-art milking parlor.
So we completed that just in time for 2008, when the worldwide financial crisis hit.
Milk prices tanked, and Roker couldn't pay his bills.
I would get in the truck and I would drive out on our back 40-acre field and sit in the truck and just cry. I never thought depression would happen to me, but this financial struggle and feeling that you're losing this legacy that your grandfather started, and it just really played a lot with my mind.
broker saw several therapists, but none were farmers themselves.
I went to so many different ones, and not one understood what I was going through.
But after about 6 years, Roker recovered. Then came the death of his neighbor, Leon Stotts. In his obituary, Leon's family was clear about what happened, writing, "He passed away after a long-fought battle with depression."
And my kids and I, when we wrote the obituary, we all met at the funeral home, and they says, "No, we need to put this in here because people need the reality check. This happens. We need to own it. And now where are we going from here?"
Randy Roker, who's known Brenda since high school, was asking the same question.
And I overheard some people talking about Leon, and I said, you just don't have any idea. You don't know what we're going through out there."
Roker and Stotts felt they needed to do something, so they started a group called the Farmer Angel Network.
We're bringing mental awareness into the light, and we're making it okay to talk about it.
Farmers can tell a story about getting hurt or, you know, whatever else is going on, but to say that they're just in a really bad place, they're really blue, they just can't get going, they'll never admit that.
Why can't they admit that?
Because just like Leon, it was weakness. And it was fear of other people knowing.
To counter that stigma, Stotts, Roker, and their volunteers set up a booth and hand out pamphlets at events around the community and give talks to spread the word about suicide prevention programs.
But 988 is there as a support.
And the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
We are not mental health people, but we are bringing resources to the forefront. Because when I went through everything with Leon, I didn't know of any resources at the time.
Welcome to Mental Health First Aid.
Other groups like the Sauk Prairie Healthcare Foundation in Wisconsin are teaching people who interact with farmers to recognize signs of distress and intervene. Anyone from a neighbor to veterinarians who visit the farm.
What you can do is say, "Bob, I'm still concerned about what I've noticed. And I want you to know that I'm available to talk to you anytime."
And at the Wisconsin Farm Center, Karen Endress helps get farmers vouchers to cover the cost of counseling and help locating therapists like Megan Wolf.
Karen will call me and she'll ask, "Hey, do you have room for," and then she'll give me a general situation.
Wolf also grew up on a hog farm.
Well, I definitely think having a farming background helps build rapport immediately, right? You don't have to explain it to me because I get it.
Wolf understands a farmer's schedule and stays flexible.
If they have a go day, like their crop is ready, that means their cancellation is happening. And you have to be okay with that as a therapist. A rainy day like today, it's a great day for me to connect with some of my farmers, especially via telehealth.
One of the things that I know that you've struggled with lately...
Wolf says telehealth is not just convenient, it's also more private, especially in small towns where everyone seems to know everybody.
A lot of times we find also that telehealth reduces the stigma and the shame of maybe walking into a building where people know that, oh, that's the therapist. A lot of my farmers I see are not even in Southwest Wisconsin. I don't know them. I don't know their family. They don't know me.
And with the vouchers the state of Wisconsin offers, an appointment with Wolf is free of charge.
The demand for vouchers has grown tremendously. Last year, we hit a record high. We paid for 217 appointments.
What do you think explains that increasing demand?
I think awareness.
Brenda Stotts, Randy Roker, and their volunteers would like to think they've played a small part in that.
I don't want Leon's death and his life to be meaningless. What we went through together has taught me so much that if I can pass that on to someone else who's struggling and trying to find their way, maybe it'll give them hope that there is help out there. You don't have to go it alone.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Megan Thompson in Loganville, Wisconsin.
If you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, call or text the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988 or go online to 988lifeline.org. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.